Welcome.
Welcome.
Welcome to the Think Orange podcast.
A podcast with ideas and conversations to help you influence the next generation.
Hey, what's up, everyone? So this is 40. That's right. This is the 40th episode of the Think Orange podcast. My name is Dave. I am your host, coming to you from the Think Orange bunker. As always, I'm so glad that you have decided to tune in with us today, because we have an absolutely incredible episode of the pod right here. It's me sitting in the room by myself. My producer, Kevin, is pressing his little face up against the portal window again. He's got a little microphone in there that we sometimes give him so that he can join in. I think he's looking a little bit sleepy today, so he may not. Hey, Kevin, wake up.
Hey, I'm here.
Hey, you with us?
Rocking and rolling.
That's good to know. You got to wake up before you go. You didn't even jump in.
Wake me up before you go.
Woo! In the absence of Ashley, shout out to Ashley. I've been leaning on Kevin to do some of the musical numbers for the pod, and he's doing a fantastic job. Make sure you leave a review for him if you're listening on iTunes or Google Play or Stitcher or SoundCloud. Leave a review of Kevin singing. That would be absolutely amazing. Hey, Kevin, today we have an amazing episode. It's called Growing Young by Engaging the Next Generation, something that so many of our listeners do for a job, or they do this every single Sunday at their church. And we're going to be hearing from three incredibly smart, like totally blew me away smart type of people. The first one is Chap Clark. He is the professor. Now get ready for this, Kevin. I'm going to ask you a question about this later on, because there's a test. Chap Clark's resume, the thumbnail of his resume here is just absolutely incredible. So here he is. He's the professor of the Youth, Family, and Culture Department in the School of Theology. That sounds like Jack Black would star in that movie, right?
I mean, right now I'm already impressed.
The School of Theology.
Do you think that
could be part two to the School of Rock?
Get out of here.
If there are any Hollywood type people listening, let's get on this. School of Theology. In fact, I would love to be part of that movie if it ever gets made. I think I could do that.
Yep, you'll be the drummer.
The drummer? No yep. way, man. I'm the guitar player up the front. I'm the drummer. You're the keyboard player.
Happily.
Back to Chap Clark, professor of the Youth, Family, and Culture Department in the School of Theology and chair of the Christian Discipleship Department at Fuller Seminary in Pasadena, California. He's going to be talking about connecting with the disconnected generation. This is something that he spoke at a Orange Conference breakout a few years ago. And then straight after him, I had the good fortune to do an amazing interview with Brad Griffin and Jake Mulder. Now, Brad is the director of Fuller Youth Institute, and Jake is the director of strategic initiative at Fuller Youth Institute. Two very smart people who have just finished a four-year study of churches who are successfully reaching the next generation. I mean, if that alone doesn't get you interested in this podcast, I don't think anything will. So if you want to learn about what the successful churches are doing to reach Generation X, Generation Z, millennials. I mean, this really is the episode to be listening to. So we're going to hear from them a little bit later on. But first, look, I need to do a little bit of a sponsor push. So I'm just going to do that and let you know that today's episode is brought to you by the Orange Conference, a three-day conference in Atlanta, Georgia, for your entire family ministry team. You can discover how we can work together to do more for the next generation as we explore next year's theme, which is becoming one voice. Now, momentum, Kevin, momentum is never an accident, is it?
Never.
Never an accident, Ben. You need to realign your team, increase your influence, and communicate more clearly with one end in mind. And that end is becoming one voice. Grow and connect as a team and attend the Orange Conference 2018. Learn more and enter to win two free tickets to the Orange Conference simply by going to theorangeconference.com. Kevin, I want you to tell me, what was your highlight of the 2017 Orange Conference?
One of my highlights is always just the energy, first of all, of the attendees. People are there. They're having a good time.
Yep.
It really does feel like a party for family ministry leaders.
Yes.
A chance to kind of get it together. The second thing, Reggie's opening talk always gets me. For some reason, I always tear up. For those who listen to this podcast,
you never cry.
I will tear up on you in a heartbeat. but it's still good. And the last thing I think for me was we had, the lesson for me was really the fact that we had just launched this podcast. Mm. And so I had a chance to really work with Ashley and you and Joseph Sojourner, Brooklyn Lindsay, Tony Collier, a lot of great, fantastic people to capture conversations backstage with a lot of great leaders who were around. And so I'm looking forward to doing that again because I learned so much in the process. So I love that about Orange Conference, and I'm grateful that we can bring some of that to you all.
And Kevin, when is the 2018 Orange Conference?
If I remember correctly, the Orange Conference is the last weekend in May coming in 2018. So for those that don't know, that is April 25th through the 27th in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah.
April 25th through the 27th in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah.
And so you definitely don't want to miss it.
Now, you didn't ask me what my highlight was, but I'm going to tell you anyway, Rude.
Perfect. Thank you.
My highlight is actually the way that, you know, we get like so many thousands of family ministry leaders into this huge arena. And I don't know how this happens, but somehow the Orange team managed to make it feel like you're in a living room. Like they make it feel like you're in a small group, don't they?
Absolutely.
I don't know how they do that every single year, but I mean, that's absolutely one of my highlights. So you come to this huge event, but you actually feel like you're getting spoken to in a really small event, one-on-ones. There's plenty of breakouts. It's a lot of fun. Make sure you visit that website, theorangeconference.com. They are our sponsors today, and you can win two free tickets, which is always a great thing. Okay, so without any further ado, I'm going to throw it straight over to Chap Clark, talking about what it means to connect with a disconnected generation.
That's where we're going. So let me kind of begin with this kind of idea. Same kid, two conversations. Now, when I say kid, I partly because I'm old, partly because I have young life background. And so when I say kid, I'm referring to anybody who's roughly 48 and younger, okay? And some of you, many of you are, and clearly, you know, many of you are not. Let's just, you know, or you've lived a hard life. Let's just be honest, okay? And so when I say kid, I hope it's not offensive. I know a lot of people say student, but see, I teach students who are 22 to 80 years old. And so when I say student, some of them are even older than I am, which is, you know, frightening. But we give more time on tests and to walk in the room and those kind of things. well, in understanding kids, I'm primarily focused on this period of life between childhood and adulthood. This period of life that basically says a child has these very clear, strict, determinative characteristics that we pretty much figured out. In fact, I was two young women that went to college with my son at Whitworth and came to say hi, and we talked for a minute, and I said, are you staying? They said, oh no, we do children's ministry, so we're going to the children one. And I go, well, we're talking about that a little bit. Oh no, not really. You're talking about those teenager stuff. Well, actually, once the game changes around 10, 11, 12 years old, till, you know, roughly way after high school, way into the 20s at least, this is a period of time known as adolescence. And then emerging adults, it goes even longer than that. That's what we call the disconnected generation for a whole lot of reasons. And then I'm going to talk about who they are, what they're like, and where we go from here. Because, you know, you got same kid, two conversations. For one thing, depending on where you see them, see the context that you see them, the environment that they're in, the relationship you have with them. Let's say you meet this girl, and she's 15 years old, and you see her at church. She's got a pretty good voice, and your choir's not all that great, and so she gets to sing occasionally, so you're committed to youth using their gifts in mission. Because she's a good singer, or her brother plays bass, and so they're in a band, and because they can be used utilitarianly, then they are, and therefore you go, yay, we're committed to kids because we let the good singer sing and the good bass player play bass. Awesome, aren't we awesome? And so here's this girl, and you meet her, and she's wearing, you know, American Eagle. She listened to Amy Grant on the way over. She's doing the Christian thing. And she talks the part, she looks very great, smiles, and she's humming Chris Tomlin songs. I mean, she is really a solid believer. And you're just committed, and you tell people, this is a great kid. She's just unbelievable. She's so sweet. She's so nice. She's so great. Then you go to a movie, and if you're an employed youth pastor, you go in a different county. And So you sit and you're sitting down, and then all of a sudden this group of a bunch of sophomores in high school sit in front of you, and they're talking like sophomores in high school, and they're dressed like sophomores in high school, and they're rough, and they're texting during the movie, and they're using words that you only hear at a Little League game or a church board meeting. And all of a sudden, and then you notice it's the same girl. She's slouching, she's dressed kind of crummy, she's mad, she's mean, she's offensive, she's guarded. Then you say hi, and you can see this look of horror on her face when she realizes, I'm completely busted. But here's the problem. That's not what she realizes, because she doesn't even know that developmentally, she has multiple selves during this period known as mid-adolescence. All she knows is you've invaded her space, and she's kind of mad and puts on this guard, and you look in her eye, but you see this sheen of indifference, defensiveness, and you wonder, how's this the same kid? But luckily, most people in leadership in the church, whether they're even in youth ministry or they're elders and deacons or they're pastors or just parents or whatever role you play, most people in the church only see kids that we think are the superstar kids in our circles, in our environment. And so we think we get the whole picture for who they are. And that frames how so many people that write about, speak about, talk about young people in the church, in relationship to the church, were seeing just one little sliver of who they really are. And that's a huge problem. As you may know, Kara Powell is here, and she and I worked on the first Sticky Faith book, and a lot of us at Fuller have been working on the thing called Sticky Faith, trying to ask the question, how do we get sustainable faith after high school? But we're trying to take seriously the reality of where kids are and help the church to figure that out. We got a massive problem. Kara reports, and the Fuller Youth Institute talks about how roughly 50% of the kids that were deeply invested in youth ministry in the church in high school in 2 years have basically dropped their faith. And these are our best kids, our most active kids, and our kids who go to college, which is about a third that go to four-year college at most. And so what's really interesting is these echelon kids that we look at and say, you're awesome. We're losing 50% of them. When we started this study, I knew we were going to do a five-year deal. I fought to say, let's start in ninth grade, because between ninth grade and 11th grade, we lose way more than 50% of kids. What is going on? Why is the church having such a difficult time to get our kids engaged in the faith of Jesus Christ, where the church is vital, and there's a beautiful, organic passion that's coming from the inside out of all people in the body of Christ. We can talk about it, we can get fired up about it, we can read books about it, but we got to know what we're dealing with, and that's basically what we're talking about right now. So here's the problem. A kid can't become an adult without what's called social capital. Every child must be provided significant social capital in order to become an adult. Social capital is basically this: people in my life who are invested in me without expecting anything in return. People in my life who are invested in me without expecting anything in return. 30 years ago, this was a problem. Today, it is a catastrophe. Because who's there for kids without an agenda? Let me show you something. This is what it looks like. I use a tightrope to describe adolescent development and for people to kind of get the idea of what does it mean to become individuated enough to become interdependent. And basically, social capital is the same thing as researchers on attachment. Maybe you've heard about attachment theory. Basically, children need attachment that's gentle. And Paul writes about this in 1 Thessalonians 2 when he says, like a mother, we were gentle among you. We loved you so much. We cared for you. We gave you not only the gospel of God, but our very lives as well. So dear you had become to us. 1 Thessalonians 2, 7 and 8. And when you become an adolescent, by definition, it's a tightrope. You have the two poles because you have community support. As a child, you have community support from your family system, hopefully. And hopefully everybody else. As an adult, you have the interdependent communal system that you're part of, right? That's the poles of the tightrope. But by definition, adolescence from 10 to 25 years old at least is a tightrope, meaning you have to go on it alone. Every one of us went through it. Those of you that are roughly 32, 34 and younger, you may still be in the throes of it, realizing I'm on this tightrope. I'm on my own. I got a few people in my life. Maybe I have some gentleness, but not a whole heck of a lot. Maybe I've got a little safety net that's empowering, but I'm still, it's up to me. And if I'm 22 years old, I'm sitting listening to this, I know that my life is up to me and I'm one stupid decision from the whole thing caving in. I'm one giving in to some addictive trait that is, we know now it's chemical and DNA and so many of those people, but in the church, you step out of line, you're done. There's no room to explore. And everybody here knows it at some level, but somehow those who are 35 and younger have experienced it more profoundly than the rest of us. And those, you know, you guys need to be the ones to be the bridge between the children and the adolescents of your congregations and everybody else to go, hold on, quit talking about them that way. Don't think about them that way, because I still feel so much of that. I'm 23 and I don't know who's there for me. How can a 15-year-old believe someone's there for her? And then they need attachment that's interdependent. Every one of us does. Social capital. If you want to read more about this, a guy named Robert Putnam, he's a sociologist from Harvard. He couldn't get into Fuller, so he had to go to Harvard, you know. And so he wrote a book called Bowling Alone that's become kind of the classic popular understanding of this idea. Bowling Alone, Robert Putnam's the guy's name. Great book. But he's written a lot since, and a lot of people are writing about this, not using the term. And before I get to this, let me show you something. In 1985 to 1988, that's 30 years ago, the federal government was worried about our kids. All the major risk factors were going off charts. Divorce rate was exponentially climbing. Suicide attempts, alcohol use, drug use, more kids playing lacrosse. I mean, some really serious things were going on. And so they had this blue ribbon panel that came together to study what's going on with their kids. 30 years ago, they had two conclusions. Look at this. This is amazing. Here's the first one. And these attachments are so important, I'm just going to show them to you again. Okay. Here's the first one. Skills needed for successful adulthood had risen exponentially from 1970 to 1985, 15 years. The skills to become an adult had risen exponentially in 15 years. It became so much more complicated from 19th kids graduated from high school in 1970 to the kids who graduated from high school in 1985, exponentially off the charts. That's the first thing. Secondly, the ongoing adult support and guidance offered kids had decreased at the same rate, measurably. In 1970, if so, you ask a 25-year-old single English teacher, would you come watch our JV volleyball game? She would have jumped at the chance, even though that is the most painful thing in our educational history. Do you remember volleyball then? You couldn't get a point unless you served, right? Remember? Some of you may remember. So you had to serve to get a point. So you serve, net, oh, shoot, okay, rotate, okay, okay, go, yeah, okay, net, oh, shoot, okay. JV girls volleyball, 1970 games would take 3 days. But she'd go. She wasn't texting her friends while she's sitting in the stands. She didn't show up for 10 minutes. She'd sit there. Why? Because the reason she taught was to give social capital to kids. By 1985, that was virtually gone. In 15 years, that was 30 years ago. Ongoing adult support and guidance offered. Then they put these two things together. Check this out. Right around the late 70s, we realized these lines had crossed and they were rapidly moving apart from each other. That's what's happened. Life's become more complicated and there's less and less actual social capital. We give kids opportunities. We give them youth sports. Parents are busy all the time driving them to stuff. Give them plenty specialized coaching. We give them SAT tutors, even though it's fraud. So I let that one just kind of sink in for a second. Standardized tests, supposed to be equal for all. No, let's game the system. See, I can talk about this now because our three kids are already way gone past their SAT tutors that we paid for them. So then the guy that headed this up, James Comer, said these two trends have created a serious problem in our country, indeed a crisis. In 1985, it was a crisis. 1988, this came out. It's a crisis. Life's become so complicated that our kids aren't growing up well because they don't have people in their lives. We give them stuff, we give them programs, we give them youth ministry, we give them education, but we don't give them ourselves. If the church could just slow down enough to step back and look into the eyes of a 13-year-old, a 17-year-old, a 25-year-old trying to figure it out, maybe we could actually begin to become the body of Christ we're called to be.
All right, to help us unpack this topic just a little bit further, we have been joined via Skype right here in the Think Orange bunker. Some really good friends of the pod, Brad and Jake from the Fuller Institute. Guys, how are you?
Doing well. Yeah, it's good to be with you, Ashley and Dave.
We're so glad that you have joined us. And we're going to be unpacking this whole idea a little bit more. But I want to, first of all, get a thumbnail of who you guys are, what you guys do. So maybe if you want to take it in alphabetical order, if you can just identify yourself and then look at them trying to figure out which one's in
alphabetical order.
Yeah, they're trying to figure it out now. What you do, what your title is, and then we'll get down into the business of this interview.
Yeah, great. Well, unless we're going in reverse alphabetical order, I'll go first. This is Brad, and I serve as the director of the Fuller Youth Institute here. And we're kind of research nerds and ministry nerds, so we love to think in thoughtful ways about ministry and help leaders do what they do better.
It's awesome.
Yeah, and Jake Mulder, I'm the director of strategic initiatives at the Fuller Youth Institute. And if that sounds broad, that's intentional.
It's because he's really important.
Yeah, well, before coming here, I had a job as a financial analyst and a job as a youth pastor. And I never thought those two things would work together. But
it's a rare blend.
Using finance and youth ministry together.
Wow, you could have been the only youth pastor to ever balance a budget.
Well, hey, I did try. Excel spreadsheets
or at least
my
know
friend.
What it all means.
Yes. So good. So yes. Now you guys have just recently written a book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. The book Growing Young, it culminates about 4 years of research. And the whole idea was just trying to focus on in the midst of so many churches that are struggling in their ministry with younger generations, what can we learn from churches that are really doing well, that are thriving?
Mm.
That's the short version.
So what does it actually mean to grow young?
Yeah, the first thing that I want to make sure I state clearly, growing young does not mean that we are against older people. We at the Fuller Youth Institute, officially on the record, we love young people. We love older people as well. And in essence, we want to see churches become an intergenerational body of Christ. We want to see churches that are engaging young people, old people, everyone together. Yet, in essence, as we look at so many churches, what we see is that the group they're struggling to reach, the group they're struggling to engage, is often younger people. So this term, growing young, essentially we discovered churches that have young people. They have a high percentage of young people as part of their overall body. And in connection with having those young people, the churches are growing.
Yep.
This isn't just quick, easy, numerical growth. This is growing in all the right sort of holistic, healthy ways that you would want to see your church grow.
So, when you say young people, what sort of age range are you talking there? Are we talking teenagers? Are we talking 20-somethings?
Yeah, specifically for our study, and again, Brad mentioned that we're researchers, so to be precise, the age group that we set out to study is churches that are thriving with 15-year-olds all the way up to 29-year-olds, so kind of the later side of teenagers all the way up into the
best
end
of our life.
They are some good years, some complicated years, so that's the age range we set out to study. Part of what we learned as a result of that project, though, is this has implications for children's ministry. This certainly has implications for those in their 30s. Depending on your church, right? A young person, that could be someone who's 19. It could be a 45-year-old, depending on how old your church is.
Yeah. Out of all the churches you talked with, how often did you come across a church that was growing young?
In our study, almost exclusively, actually, we set out to study those churches that are doing an amazing job. So most of the churches, in fact, we studied about 250 of them that are growing young.
Okay.
Now, the challenge is that's not the norm for most right. churches, right? Most churches are, in fact, growing old, hence the whole purpose of our study.
Yeah, we were really convinced that despite all the negative narratives, that wasn't the whole story. So we actually asked people, tell us about churches that you know about where there's really life when it comes to what they're doing with young people, with teenagers and emerging adults. So that's how we got there. Yeah.
When you survey the national statistics, when you look at the trends for denominations, especially where the future is headed, what churches look like right now and their engagement of young people, we like to summarize it with the phrase, most denominations, and in fact, most churches are both shrinking and aging. Mm. So shrinking in the sense that they're losing members, they're losing attendees, but also aging in the sense that the average age of church attendance is just getting older and older and older as time goes by.
In your book, you say that 25 is the new 15 and 15 is the new 25. How do you see the tides shifting for today's young adults and teenagers?
Yeah. This is a really fascinating and kind of complex reality, but a lot of us can relate to this based on the young people we know. The average age of hitting some of those markers that we typically associate with adulthood, if you think about what a few of those are, marriage, having kids, kind of landing a stable career, completing college, becoming financially independent, maybe owning a home. Now, those are not universal standards across all time. If we're really honest, they're standards of the last, 50, 60 years or so from white middle-class America. Right. Nevertheless, a lot of us have sort of built our church ministries and our understanding of young adulthood around those mile markers. All the research out there would tell us that young people are hitting those markers on average, about 5 years later than they were even just a decade or two ago. And so you find, 20-somethings and folks in their late 20s who haven't hit maybe any of those mile markers or only a few. You know, even just to take marriage and childbirth, for example, average age of first childbirth is closer and closer to 30. Average age of first marriage is closer and closer to 30. More than half of folks are not married at all in the U.S. Those are just sociological realities, right, around us, kind of demographic realities. Unfortunately, the church hasn't shifted a lot with those demographic changes. What we do is we kind of stand back and we point and judge and we say, well, you're 25, but you're acting like you're 15. Rather than entering in with empathy. So what we found that these churches are doing different is they're actually taking an empathetic approach. They're saying, you know what? It's different. It's harder. It's more complicated to become an adult today. And so we want to listen to that journey. We want to come alongside. We want to understand and not just point fingers and say, well, when I was your age, which never precedes an empathetic response, right? When we use that phrase, we're about to pronounce judgment. So these churches are nurturing the kind of environments where young people feel like, okay, I can be my authentic emerging adult self. I can use a phrase like adulting and not get made fun of here. People are going to help me walk through that journey.
So these churches that are doing this well, how are they using, you use the word empathy a couple times there. How are they leveraging empathy to connect with the next generation?
Yeah. And, sometimes in real practical ways, just by their posture, by helping teach people phrases. We talked with one church. We worked over the course of a year through our cohort model where churches work with us. We work with them, and we provide coaching, and they come do cohorts here on campus in Pasadena. And this church in Tulsa, they said, we really latched on to the phrase, tell me more. And this is a phrase that one of our colleagues, Steve Argue, kind of holds up as a way to enter in. When you come up against something you don't understand, just ask, tell me more about that. When you're engaging with a, 24-year-old and you don't really get their lifestyle choices, rather than rather than pronouncing judgment, teach adults to use that phrase, tell me more. Well, this church in Tulsa, they said, you know, we began to see those words as so important in our congregation. We actually started calling them the three most loving words. And so they ended up, they literally painted them on the side of a wall on this building that was going to be used as young adult space. They said, we really want to invite, challenge, and prompt our community to ask each other, tell me more, tell me more. And in doing so, they were trying to practice empathy and learn some real skills to show empathy to young people.
You mentioned young adult space. I'm guessing that a lot of our listeners have probably wrestled through this question. Like, do we have a young adult service? Do we have something separate for those who are post high school to 25, especially in this growing young mindset? What did you see in the 250 churches you guys talked with?
Yeah, I would say one of the things we love to talk about when we talk about growing young and how it functions and really how empathy plays into this is the importance of context. And I know context can be a bit of a buzzword, and I don't mean it in that way. It was really important to the churches that we studied that they weren't just saying, oh, this is how a big church up the street, or this is how a big church across the country does ministry to young adults or ministry to youth, so we're just going to import that here. They were so intentional about starting with their young people, their children, their teenagers, their young adults, and trying to find out what is it that their unique group of young people needed. In fact, we were working with one church that was trying to figure out what to do with young adults. And they came to us and they said, okay, and this was all staff who came to us, and they said, we have six ideas. We're going to do one of these six things for young adults and figure out how to reach them. And they proceeded to name this thing, this thing, this thing, this thing, or this thing. And they turned back to us and said, based on your research and the churches that you studied, which of those six things do you think would be the best idea? And our response back to them was, well, when you talk to the young adults in your church about these ideas, what sort of feedback did they give you? And they gave each other a deer in the headlights look because they realized they had never engaged the young adults in their church in talking about what those young adults might want. So there's a whole set of ideas and different approaches that we saw, ranging from small groups that were the right fit for some churches. In other cases, it was a Sunday evening worship service or something else. But it always went back to this idea, before the churches were going to program to or program for the young people, they were going to engage those young people in a discussion about what that might they need or want to see.
So often we see churches just like throwing out an activity or an event or a program. But what you're saying is to flip it around, get the input first from the young adults, the younger generation, and then respond to what they're after. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, very much. And I think one of the areas where that becomes really important, we've seen some churches, in an attempt to be innovative or do something new, say, okay, we're not just going to offer a service for young adults to show up to, but we want to engage young adults in social justice causes, right? This millennial generation so passionate about social justice. So on the one hand, we would applaud that and say, yes, that's awesome. Get engaged in social justice. Younger generations especially care about it. But we've also found that young adults just have such a high read on the level of authenticity in the congregation. Young adults know, are they being targeted, right? Did the church just start a social justice ministry to pull them in as an outreach or evangelism strategy? I'm trying to use air quotes here, but I'm realizing I'm not on video, so it's not helping
them.
Me. Yeah, mm-hmm. Thank you for that. But young adults can smell that, oh, you just started this social justice program to plug me into. You're not truly concerned with social justice and engaging with our community. So yeah, to take that back very much what you said, I think we need to move from this idea of just how do we create programs to target young adults and bring them back? And how do we move to partnering with them to discern what God is really trying to do? And then design our responses and ministries out of that.
Oh, that's really good. Hey, I would love to just circle back for a second. Earlier on, Ashley asked you about that quote, 25 is the new 15, 15 is the new 25. I understood the idea of 25 is the new 15, but as a dad with three teenage girls, I'm really curious about how 15 is the new 25.
I first of all, since I can see you, Dave, just have to say you are in fact growing young, because it looks like there is no way you could have teenage daughters. I'll say that and then pass
you
it just to
for those of you listening, he's got a jean jacket on and a backwards hat and Nike sneakers. He's looking fly.
Oh, I am looking fly. That's really good. Well, all I just want to say is, Jake, you just made it onto the honorary wall of Friends of the Pod, and you are friend of the pod of the month. I've just created that in your honor. So how is 15 the new 25? What do you mean by that? And what's the response to that?
Yeah, well, and I'll jump back in on that, Dave. I have a 15-year-old as well. I have three kids, and two of them are adolescents. And, you know, one thing we see today, and I can see this in my own home, my own family, 15-year-olds of today are so much more sophisticated. They're not necessarily more mature, but more sophisticated in that they have so much more access to the world. And, you know, when I was 15, the internet wasn't even publicly accessible yet, you know. So the reality of, in particular, technology and the way it has very much transformed young people's access to the world and to each other. And, you know, so think about a 15-year-old today is constantly having to think about, how do I curate my identity for the vast public who's viewing my life every day through social media? And so depending on what platforms they're using, they're constantly thinking about, how am I filtering this? What's the right angle? What's the right look? And what am I, where do I belong? You know, and what am I missing out on? You know, we don't come up with terms like FOMO just thinking about adults. You know, it certainly affects adults, and there's plenty of studies on that too. But, you know, young people are in a space that, if we're honest, it's hard for us to navigate that with the maturity that we carry in however many decades we've lived. But you put a, you know, sometimes a 12, 13, 15, 17-year-old, those are very different developmental spaces, but you give them all that access to not only the world and the information, but also just the ability to kind of shape this this presence in different spaces. That's a lot to navigate. And so you've got 15-year-olds who have to navigate with adult sensibilities, and we really have given them more than they can handle.
So, Brad, I would love to know, and I'm asking for myself as well as all the parents who are listening who have teenagers, like, we all agree with what you just said. What's our best next step?
Shut it all down, man.
Get rid of this thing called the internet.
Yeah, you know, the reality is there's no going back, as much as we would love in some cases to go back. So I think we have to help the kids in our lives really actively learn to navigate those spaces, those realities. You know, we do need to model and teach balance to them. We need to teach and show by living it that we can function outside of digital spaces or without our devices for a period of time. You know, so taking breaks is important. Actually going to sleep at night is important. You know, helping kids. I'm a big fan of setting some clear boundaries, but it's not only about boundaries. It's also about helping them navigate how they're feeling and experiencing what happens to them in those spaces, how they're contributing, and some of that reality, you know, that just the emotional and relational navigation of it. I think we can do them a big service too by creating offline environments where they can just be kids and be teenagers, be with others. You know, sometimes teenagers will say, you know, they sit in their room and connect with their friends on their devices because they don't have as many opportunities to be face-to-face with their friends. A lot of studies will find that teenagers would still prefer the face-to-face if they had it. So as parents, you know, one of the things we can do is even just offer, hey, do you want to have that friend over? Do you want to get together? You know, do you want to have a movie night or whatever, where we're actually offering to create the space for what they really want, which is
connection. That is so good. I think that I know I'm going to go back and listen to those last 4 minutes because I think you just gave some very practical advice. But I'm going to let Ashley ask the next question because I'm now tweeting that the Fuller Institute says I am growing young.
It's true. Official.
Hang on to that one.
Certified, stamped, approved. It's happening.
Well, you said that providing opportunities for teenagers to go do something besides sit in their room and play on their phone would be helpful. But I'm thinking, as a student pastor, how often we would provide all kinds of things for teenagers to come do and be part of, and then they would just sit there on their phones. So what would you say to that?
Yeah, that's real. So back to the leadership space, there's something on us as leaders to, when it comes to cultivating environments, that when we think about the environment we create, and I'm not just talking about more entertainment, but really inviting them into presence. And sometimes we just need to name it, you know, hey, here we are together and we're all looking at our devices. What if, right? and creating some invitations. I know a lot of leaders who do just create really clear boundaries too around how phones are and aren't used in those spaces together. But giving them real reasons to interact with each other. I think sometimes we think if we provide good entertainment or good messaging from a platform that's going to be good enough to hold their attention, you know, what they really need is somebody face to face, and sometimes just a real clear direction of, hey, for the next few minutes, we're not going to look at our devices, but we're going to look at each other and engage this.
Hey, so can you explain some of the process that you went through? I mean, you said it was 4 years of study. What did that involve? What did that include?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. We spent so much time, digging into the research behind this that we love to talk about it. So,
Jake aged by about 10 years during those 4 years. So
he's growing old.
It's true.
Well, Dave's growing young.
Exactly. Yes. Well, and so much of the reason that we took the research for this so seriously, we're a big fan of any pastor, youth leader who would write a book based on their experience. And we think that is hugely helpful when one church leader says, this is what I did and it worked for me. But at the same time, what that lacks is the perspective of so many other voices and so many other contexts. So that's really what we were after. And the process that we went about, very first thing is we realized, okay, we're located at Fuller Seminary. We've got a lot of smart people here, but we don't have enough smart people. So first we went out and we found the smartest people that we could find, both researchers, academics, but also pastors, practitioners. We had many friends of Orange who were involved. Reggie Joyner was involved as an advisor, Carrie Newhoff as an advisor, Virginia Ward as an advisor, and many, many others. From there, we cast as wide a net as possible to identify churches who were doing outstanding ministry with teenagers and young adults. So we had well over 300 churches who were nominated. These were churches of every sort of denomination you can imagine, churches under 100 people, churches over 10,000 people from every part of the country. These were multi-ethnic churches. They were churches that were diverse in every sense of the word. And then y'all following me here, I know I'm speaking research, so just a brief pause.
Maybe
for
we need a musical interlude. Maybe somebody needs to sing for us or something like that. You think of a research song, Ash, okay?
Okay, I'll let you know when I have one.
Yeah.
You think of a good that'd be awesome. But then we went on to study those churches in three stages. So in effect, we studied about 250 churches through online surveys with pastors and youth leaders. We then narrowed that pool of churches from 250 down to about 40. And we conducted phone interviews. So in the first stage, we're doing surveys with leaders. In the second stage, we wanted to say, well, let's push beyond that. What if we started to interview 18-year-olds, but let's also interview 80-year-olds? One of my favorite interviews was with an 80-year-old church secretary. She had been working at her church for 50 years. She knew what was going on with the church and what might need to happen with young people. So anyway, we conducted well over 500 interviews in that second stage from these 40 churches. But we didn't stop there. We actually narrowed the pool again from 40 churches down to 12. And we flew all over the country visiting those 12 churches, doing focus groups, more interviews, observing what was happening. And then we put all that data together after the 4 years of research to find out. We didn't want to write a book that was 500 pages thick and everybody got bored reading it. So we worked hard to just boil all the research down to the essence. What is most important for a church that wants to move to greater effectiveness with young people?
No, we still ended up with 300-something pages, but hopefully it's not too much.
But it wasn't 500.
400 is very different than 300.
Totally different.
So I would imagine for a church that wants to be growing young, you don't start with 15-year-olds, right? That's what you mentioned earlier. What did you notice in the churches you talked to, like in their preschool ministry, in their children's ministry, in their student ministry? What were the building blocks or commonalities that you saw amongst these churches that when they reached 15, you know, through the age 29, that they were growing young?
Really great question. I'm going to answer that by talking about one of the core commitments that these churches held in common, because as we distilled all that research and all those hours, all those 10,000 pages of interview transcripts, we focused in on six exactly core commitments that we saw holding together in these churches. And one of those that really addresses your question around, like, what's happening earlier on, you know, before we even get to youth ministry. When we ask people to describe their church and talk to us about, you know, what's your church like? Or how would you describe your church to a friend? One of the phrases that we heard more than any was the phrase, like family. These people are like my family. It's like a family here, or we are family here. You know, this is one big family. That family phrase was part of this cluster of terms that we began to look at that we just called warmth. And what was interesting about warmth is that it spanned generations. It was an ethos that, as you said, it starts early. So one of the most important things they were doing early on with kids ministry was creating the kind of environment where a kid feels at home. They feel like they can be themselves. Well, that translates into, and also where it's safe to ask hard questions, because those questions, they sometimes bubble up in children's ministry, and how we handle those early, you know, really impacts what happens later. Also connecting them with entrusting relationships with adults across generations, such that then when they hit the teenage years and they're connected with the church, or if they show up for the first time and they're a teenager, they enter into a community that feels like, oh, this is really a family. It's safe to be myself here. I'm accepted for who I am here, who I really am. I don't have to perform for anybody. I don't have to put anything on. I can be myself, and I really belong. It really helps answer one of those really huge questions of adolescence, which is, where do I belong? Who are my people? Who really accepts me for who I am? It was fascinating to us. I mean, we knew community would be important to teenagers and young adults. What was fascinating was really how strong of a factor it was
this
in its
idea
churches.
Of warmth. It seems to fly in the face of what you would think would reach and connect with young people. I mean, I would think things like, you know, super entertaining programs and loud music and lights, maybe people would tend to think that that was what would connect. Are there any common myths that you guys found when people think of what it takes to grow young?
Yeah, there was a long list of myths that we ended up going about busting throughout our research. And I will say, as I name these myths, that we certainly came across a handful of churches in our research. They were as hip, they were as high energy, they were, as you can imagine.
You use the word hip.
Yeah.
You know, we're on the pod, we're having a conversation.
And he was looking at me when he said it.
Yeah.
You know why?
Dave is the hippest. He is
forever
growing young.
Forever young. Well,
there it is. We did it. Sorry, Jake. Keep going.
Going on.
Nice.
No, that's okay. But as I get to the myths, just one of the churches that we did come across, it's called VU Church. So VU Church.
If you're listening and you want to reach out, it's VOUS Church, correct?
Yes. Yeah, it is. Rich Wilkerson Jr. is the pastor. He has had his own reality show, Rich in Faith. Kim Kardashian and Kanye West, he performed their wedding ceremony. So, like, we had some of, you know, the hippest of the hip churches in there that are just doing...
Possibly hipper than Dave, but we're not sure.
Maybe, but we don't know
this
for sure.
This is my favorite episode.
But the important reality, to take it back to your question, is while some of those churches went our study, the churches that we studied, they were not like that exclusively, or we did not only find churches. Those, in fact, were a minority of the churches that we found. So some of these myths that you talk about, yeah, certainly you don't have to be located in a trendy region, a part of the country. You don't have to be a brand new church or have just planted. You don't have to have dropped the denominational title, right? It's not that we found like no one wants to go to Methodist or Presbyterian churches anymore. You don't have to have the laser light show, the smoke machine, the video conference, the multi-site with video preaching. All those things are fine. We're not against those, but we just found those things alone are not exclusively what you have to do if you're going to reach younger generations. We found so many just basic doing things in what we might say the old-fashioned way, but doing things in an old-fashioned way just with a great attention to care and love for young people. And young people are still flocking to those churches.
So without giving the whole premise of the book away, what are some of the priorities that churches might need to shift or focus on if they want to attract and keep young people?
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the interesting things about that word priority is we really found that churches that are doing well are flipping the way they think about priority. So rather than thinking about, well, we prioritize young people because, you know, they're the church of tomorrow, right? That's everybody's favorite phrase about young people. And, you know, unfortunately, when we say you're the church of tomorrow, what we're really saying to young people is like, sit down, shut up and wait. And we found that churches tended to prioritize young people in a whole different way. They were prioritizing them by thinking about them everywhere. They were across the life of the church. So we're, as opposed to, you know, we're prioritizing you because we hired a youth pastor, so, you know, be happy. Or we gave you this facility, or we gave you this, you know, this basement to call your very own in a lot of churches. Instead, they're saying, okay, we're prioritizing young people because we're thinking about them with the team that plans our worship services is asking, how does this connect with young people and how are young people involved? The team that plans the way our church serves or is involved in mission, the team that basically every area of our church, we're asking, what's the role of young people in this area? And how will our decisions impact them, as well as like, how could they actually serve and be part of what we're doing here? And so we found that in churches where young people feel like they really play a load-bearing role, like it matters. Not just it matters for them to show up so that there'll be a great event or good numbers, but it matters because they have significant work to do. It matters because the church wouldn't be the church if they weren't part of it. When young people really sense that, then they sense that they're prioritized. And it's just a different way of thinking about prioritizing young people.
I love that. I would say that one of the most common things student pastors say that they struggle with, or the tension they face, is feeling like what they do doesn't matter, or that the ministry that they lead is siloed, and that it's not incorporated in the rest of the church. So I think that's just reality for a lot of children's pastors and student pastors in the country. What would you say to them?
Yeah, this is where one of the other core commitments that we talk about, the idea of keychain leadership, becomes so essential. And we found, so this idea of keychain leadership, it's really about the question of who is it that holds the keys, who holds the power, who holds the authority in a church. And part of what we're advocating for, based on the churches we've studied, these churches were just committed to empowering all leaders, but especially young leaders, with keys, giving them the ability to step up, giving them the ability to lead. And this idea of keychain leadership, to get back to your questions, it goes a couple ways. So on the one hand, what we're saying to senior leaders, as clearly as we can possibly say it, is if you want to grow your church, if you want to have a healthy church, if you want to have a church that actually has a future, you're going to have to ask the question, who are some of the younger leaders in our church who we need to involve in positions of authority, who we need to give real responsibility, not just pat them on the head and say, oh, you look nice, you'll be able to lead someday, but really take a risk and say, I'm going to give you the keys and you get to step up and lead right now. And again, that there's risk involved with that, but that's how we got the church that we have today. We started with a leader, right? With Jesus, who said to a bunch of younger people who didn't have everything together, hey, I'm going to pass some keys on to you and let you step up and lead. So, right, we're standing in this rich legacy. So that's one side of keychain leadership. The flip side of keychain leadership that we're saying to a lot of children's workers, a lot of youth workers, is helping them think through, who are the people that you're giving the keys to in your ministry? And so often in children's or youth ministry, we think the best person to give the keys to is a 21 or 22-year-old. That might certainly be the case. We've seen churches in our study give keys in youth ministry or in children's ministry to some 72-year-olds who become the rock star volunteers in their ministry because they have time, they have wisdom, they have energy. And here's the crazy thing. So, side tip for those of you who are children's and youth workers, you start to get some of the 60 and 70-year-olds involved as volunteers in your ministry. You start to help them care about young people. Guess who are the board members at your church who are making decisions about where budget is allocated? But this is the intergenerational body of Christ coming. This is the way it's just always been meant to be, right? And we've created this segmentation and separation. I could go on that for a while. I'll stop.
No, that was really good.
Jake is just teaching all the listeners how to manipulate the older people in their church to give to youth ministry. But it's real. It's in a non-manipulative way. You know, we've absolutely heard some stories about, you know, older people who ended up really defending, you know, when it came time to cut budgets because of their involvement and their real exposure to real young people. They saw the value in the budget that was going towards their ministries.
So for children's pastors and youth pastors, if they invite a 72-year-old to be part of their ministry, what about the opposite direction? Like a youth pastor who has teenagers, let's say middle school ministry, right? And they have no way to get middle school students into the other areas of the church because that's out of their power. How do they manage that?
I would challenge the youth pastor or children's pastor who would say it's out of their power. And here's what we've seen is this, just with a quick switch of mindset, right? So a youth pastor or children's pastor often can't command someone else in the church to say, give these young people the keys, you have to. But most churches that I've met are pretty desperate to find volunteers in so many different areas, whether that's greeting. So one classic area where we've seen churches do really well with this, and youth and children's workers specifically, might be for the church soundboard or technology on a Sunday morning, and to just go to someone else in the church and say, hey, could we invite a middle school student to just hang out with you behind the soundboard? And often after a month or two, we find that middle school student is running the entire multimedia presentation of the church. But that's just right, one small step that then the church wakes up to, oh, wow, the young people actually, they can catch on. They have some power. They have some ability to do well here.
That's a great answer. Yep.
Does that connect?
Yeah, totally connects.
Yeah, yeah. I'll pitch another angle on that too. And even just thinking about the, you know, creating context for relationships. Sometimes we need to be honest as ministry leaders who primarily work with kids, primarily work with teenagers. We need to be honest with ourselves that we kind of hide out in our own space. And we are not all that excited. I mean, we signed up to work with teenagers, right? We signed up to be children's pastors. We did not sign up to work with older adults, quite frankly, because sometimes we don't like them. And I think we need to come to terms with that and look at our own relationships in the church, look at our own calendars, you know, and ask ourselves, okay, when's the last time I had lunch with somebody in more, you know, a generation that was more than a decade away from me? And if you're only connected in your church with people who are in, you know, the same decade or one above or below you, you know, how could you actually begin by building some relationships, by listening to, you know, the stories and the longings and the losses and the hopes of people in their 70s, 80s, you know, whoever it is you are not connected with. Those relational doors, we often underestimate how much that helps create ministry connections and open up possibilities and even imagination for how then we might connect teenagers or younger kids across generations.
Yeah, I really like that idea. I was talking to you guys before we started recording. As the online pastor at North Point, one of the things that I've done in the last month is bring my 14-year-old daughter in and had her running some of the CenterCam operations for our online church. And, you know, it was, I'm going to admit, maybe because she's my daughter, but I thought it was a bit of a risk. But what I saw was, man, she not only crushed it, she picked it up so much quicker than some of our adult volunteers did.
Nice.
So much so that we moved her to being an assistant producer on it. And the energy that she brings is incredible.
That's amazing.
So that's another benefit, right? When you hand the keys over, as you were saying, to a teenager or somebody who's a couple of generations younger, they bring a new life. They bring a new energy to something.
Yeah, and Dave, you're speaking our language, and you're hitting on several things that we've found so important. I mean, so much of this is the essence of growing young, is when we're engaging young people well, when we're giving them the keys, when we're connecting them in intergenerational relationships, older generations don't lose out on that. When there's that relationship, one of the senior pastors in our church said this: everyone in our church wins. Everyone in our church rises when we focus on young people. And there's some really poor ways to go about engaging young people where you hurt a lot of people and you just push others out and say you don't matter anymore. But there's some really beautiful ways to go about engaging and involving young people that honestly, it's good for everybody in just the way that you indicate.
Couldn't agree more. So, guys, where can our listeners get a copy of Growing Young?
Yeah, well, most anywhere you can buy books, including Amazon, but in particular on our website, fulleryouthinstitute.org. We have not only the book, but a whole host of resources and a bunch of free stuff. If you go to fulleryouthinstitute.org and look under the Growing Young tab, we try to give away as much as possible to help churches have better conversations, to resource other leaders and parents. We also have an assessment we've developed that if you're not real sure how your church is doing or how people are, you know, perceiving how things are going in your church, our new church assessment helps a leader really take the pulse of their congregation in a way that can help open up some of those conversations around these topics.
I'd imagine a lot of our listeners don't have to be convinced that children and teenagers like can make a difference in the world. I'm sure they're like, you know, throwing high fives in the air to people and really excited about what you're sharing. And if they were wanting to talk to their leadership about it and their leadership wasn't going to read a whole book called Growing Young and they weren't going to go to all these different resources you mentioned, if there was one thing a children's pastor or a youth pastor could bring to their leadership for them to start thinking about it, what would it be?
I'll jump in here, and I would say take the assessment and bring that to the senior leadership in your church. We actually designed this whole assessment out of conversation with senior leaders because we found, just like you said, so many churches would say, oh, we love young people. Oh, we prioritize young people. Oh, we want to focus on young people. But often the voice of young people in the church is not heard. And so much of the reason for this assessment is it's something a children's worker, a youth worker can take. They could involve some other leaders, get some wider perspective, and really be able to go to their church board or their senior leadership and say, look, we've done some of our homework. Here's a little bit of what we've learned. And often a senior leader, they see an assessment and they think, wait a second, this isn't a children's ministry resource. This isn't a youth ministry resource. This is a whole church resource. And all of a sudden, you've just started a whole discussion about how do we, in holistic ways, engage younger generations.
That's great. We'll make sure to include a link to that assessment in our show notes for you guys as well. Hey, we just want to really thank you guys for being part of this conversation. We want to thank you so much for everything that you've shared. You guys are doing a fantastic job.
Hey, thanks so much. It was an honor to be with you and to be in this conversation. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, our pleasure.
Kevin, didn't you just think that was an absolutely amazing interview with Jake and Brad?
Yeah, and I've had the pleasure of knowing those gentlemen and working with them on a project once or twice, and these guys are fantastic people, first of all.
So smart.
And very smart, and they really care about what they're doing. I mean, to commit yourself to a four-year research project, taking in the data, a lot of questions, at a scholarly level, I mean, to have validated learning processes and all these methodologies. Yeah. I mean, these guys really care about what it means to see the next generation have an authentic relationship with Jesus Christ.
Yeah. What I loved is I feel like they spent 4 years helping every person who listens to this podcast. I feel like that's what they did for us, and we were able to bring you just some of the highlights, some of the thumbnails of some of the stuff that they've learned. Kevin, I really love that bit where he said, when we tell young people they are the future of the church, we're basically telling them to wait. I'd never thought of it like that before, but it makes so much sense now.
Absolutely. You can, for you to say, I don't know why the next generation is not engaged. It's like, well, if you're telling me I'm the future, then I'm going to wait my turn. And unfortunately, to many leaders, that looks like passivity.
Mm.
But in all honesty, it's them trying to respect what you've told them to do.
Yeah, that's so good. Kevin, that was very scholarly of you.
Well, I just listen to the smart people and I just repeat what they say, and somehow it works out really well.
You do listen to a lot of smart people. It's awesome. Hey, so we really hope that you got a lot out of today's podcast. We would love to hear from you. The best way to do that is to go to thinkorangepodcast.com. There's some places there where you can connect with us. You can also find the show notes there for this episode. See some of the smart things that Jake, Brad, and Chap had to say on this episode. You'll also see some of the tweets that we pulled out that you can share right from the page. We've made it super simple. And if you want to discuss this episode with your team, with your ministry team, we've provided you with all the questions as well. So make sure you check that out at thinkorangepodcast.com. Also, take a moment right now to hit that subscribe button. That really gives us a thumbs up. It helps us to keep getting this podcast out to more and more people. Leave a review, especially of Kevin singing. He did sing us a little song today, and you probably should grade that. I think it's totally worth it, don't you, Kevin?
Yeah, as long as it's an A.
As long as it's an A.
Yeah, if it's anything less than an A, I don't want to hear about it.
Well, I want to hear it regardless, and make sure that you also share it with a friend. We love when you do that because we want to share the love around. Well, thank you so much for tuning in to episode 40 of the Think Orange podcast. We can't wait to see you next Tuesday right here at exactly the same place. And in between time, make sure that whenever you think the next generation, think orange.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Think Orange podcast.
Join us next time for more ideas and conversations to help you influence the next generation.
For more episodes and show notes, visit thinkorangepodcast.com.